no until it's on that case.
Right here, the little thing.
That's what I said when I read it.
They don't know the police officer himself.
The police officer himself.
Yeah, we don't care the place where the police officer is.
Yeah.
You're assuming that.
Yeah.
That doesn't cover the situation. That doesn't cover the situation where the officer is on. Maybe we ought to just leave it the way it is.
Well, but does having, if that happens to be the case, is that it, that is the situation where he's directed by a police officer?
Well, but if the police officer has the authority, then the first half would take care of it. Take care of the private citizen. In other words, you ignore the last half of the sentence. But if the police officer doesn't have authority, then you invoke the last half of the sentence. Where in fact the private citizen doesn't know that.
Not liable no matter what happens.
He's liable in the one case where he knows the police officer doesn't have authority. Doesn't want authority. There's three cases, one where the officer has authority.
Just putting he is directed or authorized by a police officer to use physical force unless he knows that the police officer himself is not authorized.
He is directed or authorized by the police officer to use deadly physical force unless he knows that the police officer himself is not authorized. That's your
not so authorized.
All in favor, denied amendments, denied. Opposed, no.
That would make me a fool.
Now 15 is one that was really thrashed around. It's what's called the no sock rule. Now, I wonder, what is the wish of the commission with respect to the attorney?
How long do you plan to run it tomorrow?
Well, we're going to meet at 9:30 tomorrow, and we've been going for 5.5 hours now. And I wanted to get out of here by about 4:15, if that was possible, I suppose.
Today?
Yeah.
I'm more interested in the question getting out early tomorrow, because I've got to stay here today.
All right. Well, we can go to 4:30.
Well, we only have four more sections.
Yeah, not right. All right. Let's see how we can go.
Okay, now section 15, I think best explained by this commentary and summary. And the rationale and the principle of the section is that to authorize or encourage a person to engage an arresting officer in combat because of a difference of opinion concerning the validity of the arrest produces an unhealthy situation. The orderly procedure dictates peaceful submission to duly constituted law enforcement authority in the first instance. That if it develops that the officer was mistaken and the arrest unauthorized, ample means and opportunity for remedial action and force are available to the person arrested. So we have said a person may not use physical force to resist an arrest by a peace officer who is known or reasonably appears to be a peace officer, whether the arrest is lawful or unlawful.
We have done all right on that. There's by any
I'm moving it down from section 15.
All right, Senator Junstead has moved adoption of section 15. Is there any discussion on it?
Questions? Well, the guy knew damn well a guy that, in fact, reasonably looked like or appeared to be a peace officer. There wasn't a peace officer, but was a kidnapper.
Well, if he reasonably appeared to be a peace officer, you can't get
it. Well, isn't it a subjective thing?
Change it,
yeah.
No, we do it.
Yeah.
that definition does not include a juvenile training school or a state hospital.
So this doesn't either?
No, that's not right. This would be your prisons and penitentiary and correctional institutions. And he can use deadly physical force, including deadly physical force, when to the extent that he reasonably believes necessary to prevent the escape of the prisoner from the facility.
Now, is that a repetition? Can a guy out here on the tower shoot down somebody
Yeah, he can under, now, 163-100, justifiable homicide.
What does this do to a work release situation?
Of course, you see, before the other man, he would be a felon.
Or near the construction line.
Now, but one thing that depends on is you have to be careful about it. Unless you have this guy, you just make sure they know what that guy's in for checks, whether he's in for rape or something.
Well, all they have to know under this is that he's a prisoner. He appears to be trying to escape.
They're asking, isn't it covered under someplace else? It isn't, because only if it's a felony involving force or violence.
So if you're in the Portland City Jail because you've accumulated 96 parking tickets and you have posted to bail and you escape, and you use deadly physical force to prevent it, right?
you're the last guy to be clapping.
One thing I know about this is you may employ the detention facility. I assume the state police officer would get a breakout. I don't want to be able to use deadly force. I should have
Well, of course, they're covered under our other sections on preventing an escape.
No, only if it's a penalty by force or violence. See, if that
escape,
they do. But you add a different dimension here, don't you? Because they're escaping from within the confines of discipline.
Well, the reason I bring up. Work release, however, is that in Multnomah County, I think this is true in other places as well, persons are placed at correctional institutions,
right,
who are on work release.
Right.
And also you have there those who have been convicted of crimes, and I take it that would be a detention facility.
Well, yeah, it is.
MCCI would be a detention facility.
Right. Hold on.
Then
he can go out at 7 o'clock in the morning, go out and go to the dump, and he can't try to escape it. He can escape and can walk away from the job, but he can break out of the facility in the middle of the night.
Wouldn't it, to an extent, you had a guy on work release, and not on work release, and said, well, what you do is you send the guards out and shoot at him.
I'm not so sure that would be the result. That's the reason I raised this, even though it's late today and I hate to. Because your escape statutes have been pursued, if I'm not mistaken, that he is in custody for purposes of committing the crime of escape, even though he's out of work release.
Yeah, we talked about it. He's not in the detention facility.
In the detention facility.
As long as that's what you mean. That's fine. We're talking about as long as he's not physically.
Yeah. Well, I think that ought to be able to make a comment. From a detention facility, we don't. It wasn't our intent that I can go out to a guy's job and have to be driving by it and see him walk away from the job, close down and shoot him.
But if the guy at 10 o'clock at night gangs together with a bunch of other guys and tries to break out of the MCCI or something else, then they use whatever force necessary to stop them doing it. Let's do these questions.
Is your question resolved, Jim?
Yes.
All right.
Legislative
history. Right. Is there any other questions with regard to 16?
No.
Sprawling moves that 16 be adopted. All in favor, do it by voice vote if you don't mind. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Unanimous, yeah, carry. Section 17.
All right, 17 codifies the duress defense. Now, there's quite a difference of opinion among the states with respect to the defense of duress. On page 42, we'll point out that about half the states now have statutes on duress. We don't, of course, now. And according to the American Law Institute, most of the state statutes do not recognize the defense in respect to the most serious crime. The three states do not allow the defense to a murder case. We, in our draft, do not allow it to a defense to murder. The Model Penal Code, New York and Michigan contained no exceptions. In other words, they would allow the arrest to be defense of murder. The Illinois Code does not allow the defense in case of crime punishable with death. Cite some Oregon cases here, which I think are rather important. Only three cases I could find talking about this defense. Page 43, there's some language. The authorities seem to be conclusive that in common law, no man can excuse himself under the plea of necessity or compulsion for the taking of the life of an innocent person. That's language from State v. Westland, 1923 Oregon case. So, from the standpoint of not allowing the defense to charge a murder, we would not change Oregon law in that respect. Subsection 2 does not change the Oregon case law with respect to disallowing it in the case of a person who's placed himself in a situation where, in other words, an accomplice to a capital crime or something. The State v. Ellis case of sight. State v. Patterson. Such compulsion must have arisen without the negligence or fault of the person who insists upon it as a defense, as language or in the case law. So we don't think we change that Oregon law in that respect. Now under sub 3, we do change Oregon law, I suppose, although there are no cases that I can find where this has ever been raised. At least no reported cases. But there, the common law in defense of coercion, I think under Oregon law now, would be available to a woman when she acted up in the manner of her husband. So we would take that out of the law by sub 3. The standard that we've used here, which force or threatened force was of such nature as or degree to overcome earnest resistance, the language we finally settled on in the subcommittee, and it's similar to the language we use in our definition of forcible compulsion in our statutory or in our forcible rape provision, the degree of force that we're talking about. In other words, it requires some effort on the part of the individual to resist this force or this threat all the
playing or the novel for the importance of being there.
This would be a defense command.
Yes, it would.
But I feel that when you're trying first to convert a case, they bring in the duress defense in case three, you could have to get down the manslaughter and try to convert it.
Well, if they had a defense of duress, well, they could raise it.
Well, you know, Frank's question is, how do we define murder?
Well, you might want to,
you might want to check it, make sure that the
phraseology is consistent with what you end up with a suicide article.
Well, yeah, we did, and murder. Murder is used in our.
We just did 1 degree of it. Yeah.
That's right. It's.
You want to be recorded at 49?
We're going to change the motion before it was a motion.
Well, you just made it.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'd like to be recorded.
We don't have any degrees of murder. I don't have homicide.
At home, but the man's part is not murder.
No, not under a car.
You changed the word. We'll bring it up.
Is the law present when you feel this posture? I mean, if I turn a gun on Dave and I say, Dave, take your gun and shoot Kenny's leg off, or I'm going to shoot your leg and shoot Kenny's leg off. It's the law that he wants us to perfectly permissible.
And he's bruised and resistant.
And your force is such to overcome that resistance.
The cases have said you can't take the life of a person. Not only in Oregon, but I mean that's you know, universal a rule. Maybe.
Yeah. But I don't remember whether I raised this or not, but in subsection 2, there are reckless swing license in the South, in that provision, defines this area as a defense, even though it didn't mean any of the neighborhood of reckless. Without the intent to go along with it.
Well, that's now State versus Ellis, and also State versus Patterson. Comment upon that, and they specifically say such compulsion must have arisen without the negligence or fault of the person. So we don't change the case law. Now you may disagree with the case law, but we weren't trying to change the case law.
This is, I just got it from that case, but it was reckless. Doesn't have been great.
What type of situation is that? The reckless.
It's hard to figure the situation. Get into it. Or maybe he goes out to
Or he goes along with, say, on a planned armed robbery, and it develops that, somebody resists, and one of his accomplices says, shoot the guy. And he says, come on. And so his accomplice tells him, if you don't, I'm going to shoot you. Or, yeah. I mean, he's put himself in this situation by going along with armed robbery.
Could you ever say this? Would you ever assign recklessness to getting bad company? Is that ever?
I don't know where this recklessness would come in the other.
Well, but the recklessness or the intention has to be to put himself into a situation where he probably would expect.
I get some expression from the commission how they feel about it. I just kind of have a hang up that just because someone threatens a person, another person with deadly physical force, they may have the right to use deadly physical force on a third person. I just get hung up on that. The commission, how would they feel about entertaining, rather than just murder, any crime involving the application of deadly physical force? It just doesn't seem to me that you've got some responsibility as a citizen. Not just to save your own hide, you can apply the same amount of deadly physical force to an innocent third person. Did you have a question, Judge?
Yes, I didn't get it. That's Jim Burton, but he was. What does Section 2 do? Does that make it a question of law or a question of fact? Looks to me like you're saying it's not available. What are you going to do as the judge instructing?
Well,
are you going to just automatically rule it out?
No.
Well, then you say it's not available. Well, there's something wrong with the language.
It's a defense. Well, it's a defense in the sense that we've used it here, namely that it's up to the defendant to object to the case and then the burden is on the prosecution to prove the case beyond a reasonable doubt.
You don't really mean not available then.
Well, what I take it what it would be that if after the defendant injected duress into the case, the prosecution on the buzzer would attempt to show that he recklessly put himself in a situation. And then the court would instruct by saying, duress is a defense if you find, and so forth, sub 1. Then say, however, it's not a defense if sub 2. And you instruct in that fashion to get the jury to decide whether it was duress or whether duress wasn't available.
I would concur, but I think there's the wording not available is
I think we've used similar wording in the other defenses that we now pressure them on.
Listen, do you wanna think about it tonight? The subcommittee wrestled with this particular section hard.
Right now.
on two different occasions. But
if I were him, I'd keep the devil out of the guard out there. I'd say, you know, every time I'd say the chief con out there threatened you with this deadly force.
What do you think the chances of the 9-10 jury?
That's a good question.
Of course, one got off with a 10.
Well, that was just
10 9 and 2
All right. Judge Burns, we'll do it. We take it up to the board.
Can we leave our stuff here?
We leave it right here.
Unfortunately, we can. I finally figured out the reason that there are very few great women poets is because women don't shave. While I was shaving this morning, it occurred to me a couple. One is entitled Lines Written a Few Miles Above the Benton County Courthouse. There once was a knight whose horse kicked with deadly physical force. So I reasonably believe his widow must grieve because he failed to consider the source. And the other one is Ode to a Criminal Law Revision Draftsman. Old reason is always in season, so laws aren't hard to frame. Physical force may be spent when and to the extent that reason permits the same. That is the detritus out of the way.
Is that what I'm cutting?
Now he feels he can come in.
Yeah.
Oh, here. Beautifully timed. Beautifully timed.
Go ahead, no, Jim. No. What are you laughing at?
Well,
we had some poetry here before you came up.
That'll open your eyes.
Get your face out of the room.
He's on and has a way.
Allen Ginsberg on Criminal Law. Let's take up Durant. There was a motion that the Attorney General had made with respect to passing it. However, I think we all wanted to look at it a little bit longer, so what do you think?
I was satisfied with that thing I read about breakfast.
You had a question, Jim. Mm-hmm.
As I recall, I think the point Lee was making, it wasn't Lee, somebody else. One of the Walt Foster raised the point that the words "is not available" in subsection 2 would be could be subject to misconstruction, and that perhaps some redrafting could be done, which would.
I think you answered him.
Make it clear. Well, we were talking about some alternate wording about the time.
Well, I suggested to the judge, this was after the meeting of the adjournment, we might frame it in terms it is not a defense, or duress is not a defense, if a person intentionally or recklessly places himself in a situation in which he probably would be subjected to duress.
I think perhaps that'd be a little better wording. Mr. Chairman, I move that we amend it. Sub 2 is just described by the town.
Okay, is there any further discussion on the motion? If not, all in favor, see if I would say aye. Opposed, no.
Representative Haas got a question also to me. Isn't here yet, so.
Well, Don, before we get to that, implicit in your motion, Judge Burns, would be to change the language both as to 2 and 3, is that right? So it would be the same. Only for 2.
No, only for 2.
Only for
2. That would make conform to 3, because 3 is.
Yes, that's right. They would conform, though.
well.
Representative Haas had a question. It was bothering him somewhat, I think, that we were accepting only the crime of murder from the scope of the defense. And he said he was going to bring this up today, and so I don't know how to raise it now if you want to have any discussion on that, whether or not you wanted to extend under Section 17. The only crime that we exclude from the defense would be murder. And whether or not there would be any other serious crime that you think should be excluded. Now, as I pointed out on page 42, according to the ALI, most of the states don't recognize the defense with respect to the most serious crimes. There's some difference from state to state. They all exclude murder, but some of them exclude other crimes. Crimes such as rape, and aggravated assault, and this type of crime.
Excuse me, Mr. Chairman.
Well, does anybody have any thoughts on that?
I reckon as it is.
Well, if that's the case, then are you ready for the motion that we have before us?
Do we have a motion?
Approve it as amended.
Approve Section 17 as amended.
All right. Motion is we approve Section 17 as amended. Those in favor say aye. As you're made. Well, I think we can just do it by voice vote. Anybody in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Okay. Carried. We've got one more to go.
Yes, Section 18, Mr. Chairman, codifies the entrapment defense. All I have to say about it really, we've in sub 2, we define induced and as meaning if the actor did not contemplate, it would not otherwise have engaged in the prescribed conduct. And we go on to say, which I think is something that should be in there, merely affording the actor an opportunity to commit an offense does not constitute entrapment. I don't think there's anything in there that is a departure from.
Well, I hope not, but the only thing that bothers me is that it means that the actor did not contemplate what the cases say, and I agree with him, is that he didn't initially contemplate it. Now, if that meaning is carried on,
this is what bothers me about the thing is that you say it's a codification of the American Oregon law, and yet it could be interpreted as being the present Oregon law if interpreted properly, but it's very much subject to being interpreted otherwise, like merely affording the actor the opportunity to commit the offense. Does that mean just the person walking along the street and waiting for the pusher to come up and offer to sell him some stuff? Of course, that would be okay, but what if the undercover agent has to go and ask the seller to sell him some stuff? Now, is that merely affording him the opportunity, or is that
jury question?
That's clearly not entrapment under the present Oregon law, but it could be entrapment under this.
I don't think so, Frank. If your typical case is one where the undercover agent says he offered to sell, and the defendant says he asked me to sell it to him, that's what it usually boils down to. It's a jury question. Because your evidence is usually mixed on those boards.
But under the present Oregon law, it's perfectly all right. It would not be entrapment if the officer asked him to sell it. The undercover person asked him.
It could be. It could be. If the jury found that
he wouldn't have otherwise done it.
He wouldn't otherwise have done it.
Well, I mean, if the undercover agent has to, persuasion, is what they say in here.
Is that the LeBron case?
Yeah. An otherwise innocent person who uh,
Rodden case seems to rely primarily on this Judge Hands.
Well, yeah,
this is a good shorthand statement. I'm not so sure it's in these times. It says, one, did the agent induce the accused to commit the offense charged in indictment? And two, if so, was the accused ready and willing without persuasion? And was he awaiting any propitious opportunity to commit the offense?
Well, I think as long as we say it as the present Oregon law, Oregon law, I suppose if the prosecution can satisfy the jury that the accused was ready and willing to commit the offense charge whenever the opportunity offered, in that event, the inducement which brought about the actual offense was no more than one instance of the kind of conduct in which the accused was prepared to engage. The prosecution has not seduced an innocent person, but has only provided the means for the accused to realize his pre-existing purpose. The proof of this may be by evidence of his past offenses, of his preparation, even of his ready compliance. Obviously, it is not necessary that the past offenses proved to be precisely the same as that charge, provided they are near enough in the kind to support an inference that to the purpose included offenses of the sort charged.
Well, I think the language here.
But how about the language that that comes with?
Well, so long as we make it clear that defying the existing law. I have a question also, Don, on your deal about because he was induced to do so by a law enforcement official or by a person acting in cooperation with a law enforcement official. Now, is that latter section the current law? Does entrapment arise where the buyer, let's say, is someone acting in cooperation with a law enforcement
officer? Yes, I think it does. If you have an agent,
an informant.
Right, someone who's been sent out for the purpose of inducing someone to commit a crime so that you can have evidence, testimony against that person. I think that the scope of entrapment is not limited just to actual police or law enforcement people.
But they have to be acting at the direction.
Oh, yes, right.
Yeah. Right. Okay, is there any other questions about entrapment?
The model penal code says that entrapment is like the officer or anybody acting under the direction makes knowingly false representations designed to induce the belief that the conduct is not prohibited, or employing methods of persuasion or inducement which create a substantial risk that such an offense will be committed by persons other than those who are ready to commit it. And this seems to be a little...
Where is that?
On page 62. That seems to be, to me, to be a little clearer to what we're getting at.
Well, yeah, one thing is, looking at the presence of the law, it's a little bit vague as to what it is.
Well, it's known to be a little vague.
Yeah,
it's different.
Well, I just had the opposite reaction to the model penal code language. I felt that it obscured the defense more than it clarified it, but that's just...
Well, I think it seems to me that the Brown case and the federal cases which it relies on, it's understandable. It struck the jury on it. Nothing hard to understand about it. It's a scaly defense. Almost never succeeds. Once in a while, it may.
I know some of the code is a matter of law.
In the big deep part.
Works for speed tickets and so on Dundee, doesn't it?
Halfway around the bus
driver. You have to get that in once a day, don't you?
Yeah. Well, there's a bunch of ivory in there, and job in front of him, just over the speed limit, and then Pinskin could go as fast as the cop is.
Well, what do you want to do?
I move we approve section.
Second motion.
Now, you move the second, we approve section 18. We do it by voice vote. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, no. Carried.
Well, we have put in the commentary that that we intend this to mean what is set forth in the Broom case that on pages, in Judge Hand's language is pages 69 and 70.
We almost said that's what we're doing in commentary in section 18. So section 18 is the doctrine of entrapment and fight for Broom.
I think we say it, don't we, Frank?
I think so.
Well, we say it restates the doctrines of entrapment. We make that clear that we mean that. We mean this here to mean what the Broom case says.
Isn't that what we're saying? We're saying that we.
But I think
this
we,
section means the LeBrun case.
But I think we run into a danger if we isolate a paragraph or something out of a particular case and say this section means this.
You just want part of the LeBrun language. You don't want all of it.
Well, I don't care if the whole thing is there, but the thing is what bothers me is that merely affording the actor an opportunity to commit an offense does not constitute entrapment. Well, that the going around and asking the pusher if he will sell to the undercover agent, this could possibly be interpreted as entrapment under this.
I don't think so. Because if both the officer and the defendant agreed that the officer first said, "Will you sell me some pot?" Assuming there are other circumstances, such as the location and the previous habits and all this other thing, it would still be a jury question for entrapment. You wouldn't have entrapment as a matter of law merely because both the defendant and the officer said yes. The officer asked.
Well, maybe what scares me is that some judge is going to instruct the jury that if you find that the officer first asked to sell, that would constitute entrapment.
That's why we got the Court of Appeals.
But that's why we don't have the. You give the state's right to appeal, and then I wouldn't argue with you so much.
Sounds to me almost like suppression of evidence. You probably got a right to appeal.
Well, you want to go on? You want to make a motion, Frank? Or?
Well, just so long as it's clear that I won't make a motion. Just so
you've been talking to Bob Chandler during the recess.
The utility of our emotions has finally come back to both of us.
Alright. Let's go to inchoate crimes.
Is there a vote on this?
No.
Yeah.
Section approved.
Yeah, we approved it. Did you vote on that last motion, Harl? On entrapment? No. Alright. George, it's all yours.
Is every section been approved now?
I haven't voted on it.
No, they've all been approved.
Are there any sections that were not voted on? Okay.
We're going to spend the next 4 days having George Platt define the word inchoate for us.
One of my students asked me how to spell it in class the other day. I wasn't sure, so I told him to look it up.
No, Mr. Chipsky.
The crimes we'll talk about now cut across all the fields of criminal law, because obviously these three crimes of attempt, solicitation, and conspiracy are not in this sense complete in themselves, because they always have a different criminal goal or a substantive criminal offense which they're designed or part of, designed to accomplish. Attempt, I think we have to keep this in mind, because to cause some trouble in the subcommittee is a concept. The primary purpose of the law of attempt is to neutralize dangerous individuals. That is to say, the primary purpose is not to deter the dangerous act. It's first to focus on and allow the police to intervene at a sufficiently identifiable early time to neutralize the person so as to prevent him from going through with his dangerous act, that is the commission of the offense that he has in mind, bank robbery or murder, whatever it may be. The first section deals with attempt, and it is aimed at dealing with two problems which have continuously caused difficulty in the law of inchoate crimes, that is the mens rea of attempt, the culpability element, and the second important aspect is the drawing of the line between what's known generally as mere preparation or preparation and the point at which the act becomes an attempt, which is punishable under this article and under most law. The first section deals with these problems in this way. It says a person is guilty of an attempt to commit a crime and intentionally engages in conduct which constitutes a substantial step. In the old law, the trouble here has been where it can't be said that the actor adverted to the circumstances surrounding the crime. And the Model Penal Code gives the example of the killing of an FBI agent, which is, of course, a federal offense. One who intends to kill an individual may not be intending to kill an FBI agent for the simple fact that he doesn't know he's an FBI agent. However, as part of the construction of that crime, the courts have said that if you're negligent or reckless with respect to the identity of that particular individual, if that's a circumstance of the crime, then you need not advert to it intentionally for conviction under the act of killing an FBI agent. Well, this section is phrased to avoid that problem because it speaks in terms of intentionally engaging in conduct which constitutes the offense. And that would encompass all the circumstances, the attendant circumstances with respect to the crime. It avoids that problem. Most of the time we don't have that problem. Most offenses are much more straightforward. The second aspect, the line drawing between preparation and attempt, is covered in the phrase constitutes a substantial step toward the commission of the crime. This is the Model Penal Code language. And it turns away from the old classical doctrines, generally known as the proximity test. The last proximate act is the most dramatic example of that, where the crime is actually fired but the bullet misses, constitutes clearly attempted murder, assuming the requisite intent. The Model Penal Code and the substantial step doctrine turns the attention to what has been done rather than what yet remains to be done, and focuses on the personality of the person who performs the act. Now, in the Model Penal Code version, several kinds of acts are listed which would constitute, as a matter of law, if the prosecution can get them in, it would allow the prosecution to get to the jury. We didn't set those out in the section because we felt that this was a part of the definition which better would be included in the historical and the legislative history of it. Those items are set out in the explanation on page 2, lying in wait, searching for, and so forth, enticing or seeking to entice, reconnoitering, unlawful entry of a structure, possession of materials, and so forth. If the prosecution can show any one of those several items, then he's entitled to go to the jury on the question of whether that was indeed a substantial step. It isn't a conclusive presumption by any means. The idea here is that the step is one which strongly corroborates the intent to engage in the criminal conduct. in connection with this, the statements and admissions of the defendant, either before or after the act, are admissible in the model penal code view within, of course, the constitutional restrictions that we have and procedure to assist in establishing the purpose or the intent of the individual when you first set out on this course of criminal conduct. This contrasts with some of the, with another test called the res ipsa loquitur test, which is applied in some jurisdictions, which says that you may only look at the acts and may not take into consideration any statement of the actor. The reliance in that test is entirely upon whether, in fact, the act of the person can be said to be identifiably criminal. The trouble there is obvious, however, since most acts, even what we would expect to be very incriminating acts, are ambiguous. And I think of one case where the actor was seen to enter a car of another and poke around in the car for a while and then leave without actually taking anything. The court held under the res ipsa loquitur doctrine that the facts were ambiguous as to the exact crime that he was had in mind when he entered the car. Apparently he was going to steal something, he was felt, but they weren't quite sure what, so the court discharged him. That carries the test to the extreme, I believe, and generally not followed, but it is a part of the law of attempt. This would not allow such a, I think, obviously unfair result. I think that summarizes what Section 1 does.
Is there any discussion of Section 1?
Well, you got me befuddled.
Well, I think it's George, I think it'd be helpful if you explained to those who were not on the subcommittee the extent to which it changes or affects Oregon law.
All right. I think it will tend to move back the line between preparation and attempt to allow the police authorities to enter sooner than presently provided. I don't think there's a dramatic difference in the shift, but the model penal code, which this follows, is generally recognized as allowing earlier interference by the police in dangerous conduct. It does not change the mens rea element whatsoever, except that it does, I believe, will clarify these tough cases, the liners, as it were, with respect to the attendant circumstance kind of crime.
Well, it makes a jury question out of whether this is a substantial step.
Right. That's right. There still is a matter of great maneuvering room with respect to deciding what the substantial step actually is. It does allow the prosecution, I think, more flexibility and freedom to take evidence to the jury.
George, when you mentioned over on page 5, or citing from the military justice draft, is it contemplated that a person could be convicted of an attempt under this section, even though the offense was consummated?
Yes. Right. And I think that represents Oregon law as it presently exists, anyhow. No one would be able to be convicted of both the attempt and the substantive offense. That we provide in Section 13, a prohibition on that. But there is some case law that if the offense has, for some reason, comes out in the trial that the offense actually was committed, though he's not being prosecuted for it, the prosecution is dismissed in some cases because of that. But I don't believe that Oregon follows that doctrine in the cases that I've read.
What's OSR, ORS 164.090? It's a certain property.
That's a property of this.
164.090.
Attempt to burn property. Any person who willfully, maliciously, or wantonly attempts to set fire to or burn any dwelling shall be the property. Guilty of arson. Attempted arson.
It's proliferation, really. It's an unnecessary provision in light of a general attempt statute.
We don't retain that, by the way, in our arson draft. This doesn't retain it. What about our arson draft? Well, we felt we didn't need it in our arson draft because it would be covered under our in-court crime.
Well, we have the present statute applied a different standard of conduct to attempt to commit arson than to attempt to commit murder.
That's true.
And we're abandoning that.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah,
we're adopting the arson one.
Because
the one that previously applied only to arson there, or at least farther that direction.
Presently, under our law now, if you attempt to commit arson or if you attempt to obtain money by false pretenses, you're as guilty as if you do.
Well,
and that isn't true for most crimes.
As I read the commentary, under 164.090, you say in the case of arson that you commit any act preliminary to an attempt to burn the property, you're guilty of attempt. Whereas, as I understood the explanation, in the case of murder, you have to go farther than commit any act preliminary.
That's right.
And we're raising the arson standard under this to the present standard. Murder, only rolling that back.
Well, you're correct, Bob. I follow what you're getting at. It's generally recognized, I think, in most existing law as well as statutes, that mere preparation or preparation to commit the crime ought not to be made criminal, because in the very early stages of action, it's just almost impossible to tell whether there's a firm criminal purpose from some of the acts. The buying of matches, for instance, can be a completely innocent act. This statute, I think, is an aberration on the law of attempt, clearly. It's not repeated any place that I know of anywhere else in ORS, and I think it does not state the law. I think it close examination by courts of this statute may very likely find that it just simply, they'd apply it out of existence, is what my feeling is. They would not accept a mere preparatory act as constituting an attempt, even though the statute says that's enough.
Well, it seems
it ought not to be applied. It's
somewhere in the past, the legislature in its wisdom has decided that either through error or through a conscious decision, I presume the latter, that arson is a perhaps more heinous crime than some of these other things, and for that reason a more important crime, or more important to stop in its early stages or something else, and for that reason we ought to apply a different standard to arson than we do to an attempt to pass a bad check or something else.
Yes, well, I think that's a bad legislative policy. If it was done consciously, then I think it is a mistake that ought to be rectified. Nor do I see any reason for differentiating with respect to the line of attempt on any crime. It ought to be a uniform standard applied, whether it be for murder or attempted bad check passing. Otherwise, we aren't going to have any uniformity in this area at all, and I think that's desirable. Bob, let me ask you, if in fact your man under the statute goes into the drugstore and buys a book of matches, this conceivably would make him guilty of the attempt to commit arson under this old statute. And I think that's my feeling, is that this is just simply too early to tell anything about that person and what he intends to do.
Well, I presume that the attorney in Benton County would bring charges against anybody who, all the back buyers of matches in a drugstore. But it's my understanding, I realize I'm in deep water for me in this sort of thing. It's my understanding that arson is a particularly difficult, or an attempt to commit arson is a particularly difficult crime to convict on.
Well, but you get some help though in these listings. For instance, on page 2 in the legislative history, they're now saying that prosecution may show possession of materials to be employed in the commission of a crime which are specifically designed for such unlawful use or can serve no other purpose. And then the second one, possession, collection, or fabrication of materials to be employed in the commission of a crime at or near the place contemplated. Now, these are specifically included to help cover the arson problem, because it is recognized that it is difficult to prove.
Using Mr. Spaulding's illustration yesterday of the simplest arson tool of all, neither one of the tools are specifically designed for the purpose of committing arson. They involve a cigarette and a matchbook.
Well, the second one I read.
He lived with it.
even in Deschutes County, you wouldn't charge somebody with arson for buying a cigarette.
That's in a book of matches.
Would you?
If they didn't buy the cigarettes and if they didn't smoke.
Yeah.
See, you're back to Benton County. Yeah.
Well, I don't have any particular thing on this one way or another. It seems to me that we are making a change in existing legislative policy and state policy, and we ought to discuss.
Well, Bob, it seems to me that we are making a change, and insofar as this arson statute is concerned, we're making it tougher to prove attempted arson than is presently the case. I'm not sure that the
we're making it easier to prove attempted other crimes.
I think
we are closer together.
I think we're bringing them, rendering them uniform, and I think that should be our desired objective. We're not really doing terrible violence to any part of the code.
Bob, you are aware of the arson statute.
Not the arson statutes at this point.
No, because there weren't any insurance people in there. Almost uniform, the insurance lobbies around the United States.
Well, our little old subcommittee didn't have
the insurance companies in the states.
Now, Mr. Chairman moves that we approve section 1.
Second.
Is there any further discussion?
I move we approve section 1.
Second.
Alright, move section. We approve section 1. Let's do it by voice vote. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. Unanimous. Section 2, Charlie.
Section 2 deals with a defense which is a classic in the law of attempt, and I believe section 2. Convinced Section 2 reflects the law of Oregon and the vast majority of jurisdictions elsewhere, demonstrated by the case where the man sets out to kill a rival and believes him to be in one bed in one room of a rooming house and fires through the window into the bed, which of course happens to be empty. The man is sleeping in another room that night. The charge of attempted murder would lie under this section as well as present Oregon law. Although, in a sense, it's impossible for him to commit the crime because the object of the crime, the body he was firing at, just simply isn't there. Here again, I remind you to keep in mind the basic concept of the law of attempt, and that's to reach the dangerousness of the person who is conducting himself or engaging in the course of criminal conduct. There was extended discussion in the subcommittee on both sides of this issue, I believe. Some felt that we ought not to punish, we ought to look at actually what happened in an objective sense, and if in fact nothing criminal happened, if nobody was hurt, he ought not to be prosecuted. That is, I say, a minority view, I believe, and that this is the best policy because it allows the police to arrest that man at that point rather than letting him try tomorrow night when he knows what bed the person is going to be sleeping in.
And who's going to be there? Move that we adopt Section 2.
Okay, you've heard the motion. Is there any further discussion?
No.
For sure, it was George yesterday.
I wish I'd had these guys yesterday. You're tired on the second day.
The jailer isn't very tired.
Well, I keep wondering.
Is that your pickup? They're towing away out there.
Right. They're going away. Well, I guess that would have been a stupid question. It would have been fell out of the top.
Chairman, George mentioned the minority view, and I was the minority view.
Figures.
But my feeling was that when you're talking about factual impossibility, and this section includes, under George, both legal impossibility and factual impossibility, that if you're getting to a factual impossibility, I think we're overkilling. The example in the commentary, as I recall, was a black magic situation where someone had a doll and believed the voodoo would work and sat there stabbing pins in the doll, believing that the representation of the doll, the man was dying. Well, you know, Should that be a crime?
If he dies, you bet.
Now, as you were saying,
my collection of dolls.
if a guy was on the census, let's see, that guy probably wasn't, but, and really was attempting to commit a crime, he ought to be punished for it, no matter whether the ability is ultimately there or not.
Well, but the point is, he can sit there and punch pins and dolls for the rest of his life and never hurt anyone.
And he can shoot at the moon for the rest of his life, but if he thinks that he can hit the moon and hurt somebody that might be there.
And the prosecution can persuade a jury to believe that pin punching holes in a doll.
If the guy, the subject of this pin doll thing is starting to get sick and stuff, well, you sure want to be able to step in and stop it before the guy died.
Actually, I pose a social conscience crime.
I use this in class, and after getting through with it, focusing strictly on the attempt law, one of my students came up afterwards and says, well, what if the fellow actually dies? And that's really the more interesting question as far as the criminal law exam question would be. But Dave, there are two responses, and we've talked about this before, but the commission may be interested. Number one, of course, is that the man who practices the puncturing of the doll with the pins may wake up to the fact that it isn't working in America. It might work in Haiti or the Dominican Republic, but it doesn't work here, so therefore he better find other means to dispose of his victim, which means, of course, that he'll escalate to the point where he does actually accomplish his criminal goal. And so I suppose, secondly, and perhaps the better answer is that the prosecution has great discretion, as we all know, in bringing the case in the first place. And Frank Knight would very closely look at this kind of person and say, this guy is nuttier than a fruitcake, and we'll just take him the civil commitment route rather than taking him into court for attempted murder.
What do you mean, Frank? Prosecute.
Put him away.
Well, we can talk about Frank. The thing I was going to ask him, since Mr. Frost is his guy, are we in any danger on this kind of thing of being too loose and vague and not defining real crimes? I am reminded of the Supreme Court's decision on contributing to the delinquency bit here not too long ago, and I realized that was poorly used by lots of police and prosecutors around the state.
This has to be read in the light of other standards, which are definite, to define what you're attempting to do.
Well, the delinquency bit was doing what we're attempting to do here, was to stop a guy and put him away.
Don't we want to get away the language in the hiding statutes on everything? I mean, I think it's desirable that it is.
What do you mean us? You got a problem with it?
Well, that seems awful problem.
The Supreme Court said it was
so the enforcement of the laws rather than the relief.
It's a little rough on the morning of the Supreme Court.
Well, you've got a friend on the court of appeals, and he's a criminal.
One of your friends is going to beat
him. Well, Bob, I think the answer is that we have a long line of decisions, both in Oregon and elsewhere, that have dealt with the law of attempt in substantially the same form. The language is a little different, but the present law of attempt in Oregon says one who does any act with intent to commit a crime. Well, that's just the same thing, really, that we're talking about here, only I think we're being more helpful because we're listing the kinds of acts in our legislative history, for instance, which will constitute a jury question on attempt. And I have no doubt in my own mind that there is no void for vagueness element here. We are talking about mens rea elements. We're making that clear, what kind of culpability he must have, and we're suggesting the kind of act that it'll take for him to be convicted of whatever element crime is that he has in mind.
Now I get to the problem of punishment or sentence. I don't understand. An attempt to commit murder would be punished under the murder provision.
No.
Under the attempt.
No, it would not. And I suppose it's a good point to raise now, because the subcommittee decided to take out the grading of the inchoate offenses. There is a section in the Model Penal Code, and there was a section in the original draft and subcommittee, which provided in substance that one who is found guilty of attempted murder shall be punished to the same extent for murder, or whatever the crime at which the person aimed was, the same penalty would apply for the inchoate crime, whether it be attempt, solicitation, or conspiracy. The feeling of the subcommittee was that this ought to be a decision on the sentencing aspects, and as a result referred the section to the sentencing subcommittee for study with respect to grading of all crimes.
Well, it seems to me it's going to be awfully difficult if you have a statute that says an attempt to commit a crime is a crime, which is basically what Section 1 says. And you find the guy guilty of an attempt to commit murder, and then the guy in the next courtroom is found guilty of an attempt to pass a bad check.
We used to have a statute, didn't we, that said that unless it's otherwise provided by statute, an attempt is punishable by 1/2.
Well, it still is. Yeah. It still
it's
is.
A maximum of 10 years.
Yeah.
Or if it's a life
presently,
sentence, it's
presently
10 years.
The, mm-hmm. If I attempt to commit burglary, not in a dwelling, the maximum is 5 years, because burglary not in a dwelling is 10. But and this is true throughout, except in those certain instances we looked at here a little bit ago, where the attempt is included in the major crime and it's like attempt to obtain under false pretenses, and it's 5 years, the same as obtaining under false pretenses. So, present setup provides a straight across the board, 1/2 the major crime.
Or, like, now at least the assault with intent to kill is attempted murder.
Sure.
And, so you've got a different substantive crime is really the attempt.
But it, the substance of the evidence felt that grading problems were such that we ought to take it up when we have the sentence.
And this generally is going to be the approach that we're going to, something along the present lines, half the present offense or a third the present offense or something, so that we've got some means of.
Yeah, the
you're not going to say
jurisdictions elsewhere are all over the map on it, Bob. That's one of the reasons the subcommittee decided that we'd rather have sentencing look at it in light of the present existing policy. Some are like Oregon, and it's certainly not the majority, where half the penalty is imposed. Some are less than that. The maximum, well, for instance, in Oregon, the maximum for conspiracy is 3 years, I believe, which is different within the inchoate crime classification. It's a different penalty.
In other words, the subcommittee was concerned about this, that the original draft provided that an attempt to commit any crime would be punishable as a completed offense, same as. And the subcommittee felt, well, that it might be better to deal with it on a more specific basis. That is, there might be certain crimes that we want to treat the same insofar as attempt is concerned. But others, we might not want to go so far as to say an attempt to commit theft, say, is punishable as the same as a completed offense. In other words, a way of dealing with it would be that, say, if you have a Class A felony grading, you might want to provide, except, say, for certain crimes such as murder or rape or some forcible rape, some of the more heinous crimes, you might want to provide an attempt to commit a Class A felony as punishable as a Class B felony, or some recognition that there would be a downgrading of insofar as the attempt was concerned, that could be better be handled in our penalty and sentencing provisions rather than under
I would guess that'd be right if we arrive at some general policy that one step down or something like this. But if we're going to get into this
in almost every case.
If we're going to get into a variety of
things. So rape all his life and accomplished rape for 20 years.
Well, I suspect what we might end
it's
up
a reward for effort.
A scheme that John mentioned. You downgrade one step down for most attempts, and with a few of them, you'd leave them the same. Or
what are you going to have to do then? Go back in and state those, or put them in the
no. You just have a general provision.
All right, well, what I'm saying is if you say that Class A felony, attempt to commit a Class A felony shall be punished as a Class B felony, this is what you're saying.
Mm-hmm. Something like that.
All right, except, something like that.
Yeah. Except in these cases, A, B, C, and D.
Then you're going to put those penalties back in the sections for arson and murder, or
no?
No. And then no, the exceptions no, to the...
Put no, this would all be under our penalty sentencing article.
Okay.
There has to be a general provision with inchoate crimes, and the Model Penal Code inserted its general provision in the article itself, and there's no reason why it couldn't be in the sentencing article just as easily. But it should be treated uniformly. That is, it should apply throughout the code without having to appear in each section of the code.
I move it.
Okay, Mr. Chandler has restated Mr. Spaulding's motion. We'll do it by roll call, I think, this time. All in favor of approving Section 2, signify by saying aye. And your names are called. Those opposed,
Judge Burns.
Aye.
Carson.
Aye.
Chandler.
Aye.
Ross.
Aye.
Haas.
Aye.
Dunston.
Aye.
Johnson.
Aye.
Knight.
Aye.
Spaulding.
Aye.
Mr. Chairman. Aye. State prosecution. Section 3.
Section 3 is a creation of a defense for attempt, and this same defense we'll see again with respect to the term solicitation and conspiracy. It's demonstrated by the example where one goes in and robs a bank, actually completes the crime, and after which he's stricken with conscience and decides that he shouldn't have done that. So he goes back to the bank and says, here's your money back, and I'm sorry, and I didn't mean it. Well, we know that that is not... it's too late at that point. He's convicted, he's committed a crime for which he must respond to the process of justice. However, if he attempts to rob that bank, gets to the point where he's actually walking through the door with a drawn revolver, and at that point, voluntarily, without any outside pressure, that is the presence of police or the fear of immediate capture, if he voluntarily renounces his course of criminal conduct and does forestall the commission of the crime, and this means that if he has cohorts with him, he must keep them from committing the crime, then this is a defense to the crime of attempt and is a complete defense. Now, in my comment, I indicate, I think incorrectly, the present status of the law. I've said a little too boldly on page 16 that there was submitted that because the provision for renunciation defense is such a new concept, virtually unsupported by existing law, I have since done some more research, and I do not think that's correct. I think it is supported. That is, the renunciation defense is supported by existing law, except with respect to assault cases. Now, in assault, here again, Bob, I'm reacting as a lawyer would, and I'm not sure that a layman would understand the relationship between a case like assault and attempted battery. They're really not different. If I come towards you with an upraised club and I have the intent to hit you, I'm assaulting you in Oregon. I have the capability and the means presently to do it. But it's also an attempted battery, isn't it? Because the battery consists of me actually hitting you. Well, now there are two crimes that they're really the same thing. They're attempt. However, traditionally and historically, the crime of assault has been identified as a separate substantive crime itself because of the nature of the thing. It threatens personal injury. It's easily identifiable. Therefore, the law has chosen over the hundreds of years of evolution to say, we won't treat this as an attempted battery anymore. We'll treat it as an identifiable crime and we'll call it assault. All right. Now, because of the nature of assault, because it does put one in the immediate presence of serious bodily harm, it's dangerous, it's obviously going to result in a real serious injury. The cases for renunciation have held that it's too late. You've caused too much of a terror, too much of a problem socially, therefore you cannot renounce the fact that you have committed an assault. Putting those cases aside, which really deal only with the now identifiable substantive crime of assault, I think the cases will show that renunciation is now and always has been a complete defense to an inchoate crime. And I think that's the best policy because it enables the people who are interested, the bank teller or the person who may be murdered, enables the police, or I'm sorry, it enables the actor to step out of his course of criminal conduct and encourages him and rewards him for not going through with what might be a very serious crime by saying, all right, King's X, we will not prosecute you for the attempt to commit the crime.
George, your example on that now doesn't work because now the hitting is going to be the assault. That waving the arm here is going to be attempted assault.
You mean under your code?
Yes.
You mean under our
you
code?
You were at that meeting when I was all...
Well, that's all right. I don't think I'd retract anything I said. In other words, the assault, the only real reservation on whether renunciation is a defense is in the assault area, and I don't think that's significant to say that we're changing the law by allowing renunciation in an attempt.
Let me ask a question, Greg.
We are stating it, though.
If we did not have this statute, still supposedly had the guy who arrested and he's got in his possession, he's fabricated a tool for opening up these parking meters, which actually is a crime. That's how I forget the fact that it is a crime. It's a crime. Attempted larceny. But I would assume even if he didn't have this statute, he would be able to either testify, and there's no way to keep him from testifying. Yeah, he fabricated the device. He decided he just got really into this, and yeah, he got religion. I guess whether he had the statute or not wouldn't make any difference.
I don't think
so.
That's true of a lot of stuff we're doing.
That's right.
No. Well, yeah, I'm just trying to figure out whether it's getting into something that isn't really opened up already.
Well, but what it does is it provides some reasonably specific and rational criteria.
Yeah. Well, we're telling the court system of Oregon, which has never had a case that I could find on renunciation, we're telling them that we prefer the majority rule as the best policy, as a legislative choice, rather than allowing the court to perhaps take the other policy of saying, no, we'll apply the minority rule of state X and find that the attempt was a complete crime, just like bank robbery. And we're going to have to punish you for it, despite the fact that you did not go through with your conduct voluntarily or not.
Renunciation, you're talking about the bank robber who goes in with his gun drawn and gets religion and hands the gun to the guard at the door, says, go on, cause I didn't really mean. Now, bank robbery also can be committed by two or three or four people, and one guy waits in the car, and so forth and so on. Yeah. What happens to the guy who comes up in the car, and the rest of the fellows go into the bank, and then he gets religion?
And he gets the hell out of there.
Then he's got to call the police.
And if he just drives the car away, leaving his fellows in the bank, is that renunciation?
No, he has to forestall the commission of the crime as well.
He has to stop it.
That's right.
Everything necessary to prevent the commission of the attempted crime, it says here. And I was wondering about that word necessary. How about everything possible?
I'll question it. Because certainly that's the intent of the provision.
What's the intent?
Is to require that anyone who gets religion also be sure that the crime is forestalled. That is too bad. The renunciation defense isn't going to help you. It's a rare, unique opportunity as a defense anyhow, and I don't suppose it'll crop up very often. It would also make it difficult for the defendant. He's going to have to introduce it in his own case and prove it by a preponderance because of the peculiar nature of the defense and his mental attitude that only he knows best about.
This is the thing, otherwise if it wasn't for the attorney defense thing, it would probably be from the standpoint where you have, say, an attempted burglary, where you've got, you know, the pry marks on the door, and they, that for some reason, they didn't have the right tools or something, or found that the door was barred back, and so, you know, they got the lock, and then they still couldn't get the door open. So you've got an attempted burglary, but they quit and left. The next morning,
door is discovered and the police are investigating, finding that they indeed were there prying on the door. Well, with this defense, of course, they're going to say, well, we pried the door and then we decided that we quit and went home. And we voluntarily and whatever it says, completely enunciated our intent. We stood about north 5 times before we got back to our car. But they're going to have to convince the jury of this by the preponderance of the evidence.
Yeah, I think just fine. Well,
actually, from some standpoint, the statute being assistance, it's because of almost the guy who decides he's going to pull out takes on an affirmative obligation to
the other guy.
That's what we have in mind.
And if he pays it out anyway, he's got to go to his prison.
I don't see what you think about that. Well,
And voluntarily withdraws himself. He will not have a defense against the conspiracy, but he will have defense with respect to the statute of limitations when starts to run, and he'll have a defense against any other crimes that may be committed as a result of a continuing conspiracy, but not the conspiracy to rob the bank. That is, he won't be able to have a defense there. It'll be a partial defense with respect to the abandonment, because he doesn't forestall the ultimate crime being committed. We're talking about a complete defense now, on the negotiation.
What the purpose? Some of the analysis is what we're talking about yesterday. But the purpose is to prevent the commission of crime. And we don't want to listen to this bird try to wiggle off the hook. Merely by saying he got a label and took off when.
As a defense, but that was deleted, the subcommittee felt it.